Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it. So Heather, after the conversation that we just had, something that it's hard not to think about is the fact that you and we say this a lot on the show, that like we're the same age, almost exactly the same age, but that we're historians of the same age. And I don't think either one of us, certainly I, in a million years before a few years ago, I would never have imagined in any way that I would spend huge chunks of my time engaging in a discussion of, yes, history, but history as it relates to the present because of the any number of crises that we're living through and that have to be addressed in some way because we're at a variety of different crises points. You know, I'm a historian of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and you have talked before about, we've both talked about our happy places, right? I love researching, and I love the looking at a past that to me feels, on the one hand, familiar because of the human component of it, but really different because the culture is so different and the language is so different, and I love figuring that kind of stuff out. The idea that that, which is how I envision my future, is really not what I'm doing a lot of right now, and that I think about that a lot because this is just really never what I thought I would be doing, and at the moment I don't feel that I can not do it. It strikes me that you've sometimes said something similar, and it raises an interesting point about what drives people to be active, to become activists. And literally, I guess the important word in that is drive. What pushes people to feel that they need to do something at a certain time?
Well, you know, it's so funny you say that because you're absolutely right. Nothing makes me happier than research. By myself in the bottom of a library where I don't see anybody for days. It's amazing. You know, you get to immerse yourself in the sources and it comes to life and you find that stuff.
Oh, no, there's something wrong with historians, right? Because that's what we love. It's like, I want to be in a room by myself with old pieces of paper. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I really love that. When I've never been unhappy in a library. Like, if things are really, really bad, I go to a library because it's just so wonderful to be surrounded by all that. And yet, yeah, here we are. And I'm thinking about that as you say that. I think I began to get involved in a more public way, you know, in the 1990s, really, because I so love what I do that I wanted to make it real for other people. And it truly never occurred to me that anything that I saw about our political system, about sort of the mechanics of how it worked, would be controversial. And yet, in some ways, it's been controversial from the start because people took either positions against the way the system worked or for the way the system worked. And still, though, I just thought of myself as a writer and, you know, I did put op-eds in places and, you know, I wrote books that people read, but maybe not a lot of people. And I loved teaching. And then, of course, you know, I'm not going to say his name, but I ended up on the first incarnation of the Professor Watch List. And at some level, when that, and then, of course, you know, I wrote a response to it and it went viral and all that. And I think maybe that was my moment of not having a choice any longer. You know, as my mother used to say, you know, something about, you might as well be hung for a sheep as for a lamb. That is, you know, I was clearly already in somebody's sights. So backing down really wasn't an option. And it wasn't because I had any skill in this or any desire necessarily to do it, although I do care very profoundly about fairness in the world. But I certainly didn't see this as any kind of a career path or anything, but I didn't really have any choice at that point. What about you?
Years ago, not that long ago, but a number of years ago, I was being filmed for something. I don't even specifically remember what online, and it was being filmed. There was someone coming on right after me, or I was coming after someone. At any rate, there was another historian who shall go nameless who was with me while we were between being filmed. And he was like rocking back and forth with anxiety and saying, basically, I don't know what to do. What can I do right now in this moment? I don't know what to do and I have to do something. And I realized it was the first time I had seen someone else express what I felt all the time, which was what's going on now feels, and I'm talking a number of years ago, feels immediate and feels threatening and feels scary. And I'm an early American political historian who writes about the founders and felt at that point and have never stopped feeling that any way that I can step forward and say something or do something that will get people to think about this moment in a different way, I will do. And I think about it all the time because I think kind of along the lines of what we're saying. I'm a historian and I should be writing a book about the political process in some other time period and what it suggests. And what I'm doing now is not something I ever assumed I would do, but I also feel that I can't step away from it. And I don't even know if what I do has much purpose or impact, but I know that I can't not do it. We're at a moment that feels so important to me, and the more voices that have any kind of a platform, the more voices that can come forward and say, this is a moment to think about, and here are tools to employ so that you can think about this moment and ideally then understand how to take action. In a way, that's very similar to what you said. It's not something I saw in advance. I didn't have the extra bonus push of being put on a watch list. It was just more this sort of compulsion that, you know, how can I not do something at a moment that I would never forgive myself if I didn't come forward to do everything that I could do and try to get all kinds of other people to do the same thing, right? Because that's the thing here is that, yeah, okay, so I'm a historian and I have a PhD and I know about the founders and I have the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is I'm just a politically minded, engaged American person who's worried. And there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of us.
Well, so I want to talk a little bit about the lots and lots and lots of people, but I just have to ask because it's been really bothering me for the last several days, weeks. One of the hard things about what we do is when we see something in the present that echoes something that we know quite well in the past, voting rights.
Yeah.
We know how this turns out. And to have people refuse to listen to that, to have people say, oh, no, you're wrong. That's not how it comes out. Now I'm perfectly willing to hear somebody say, no, I don't think that's going to happen this time because here are the places in which to this moment is different and this is how this is going to play out. And we could talk about that. But to know something as well as I'm not going to speak for you, know voting rights and how what happens when states take upon themselves to restrict voting rights among certain populations. We've done that. We know how that comes out. And to have people say, as they did in Congress, this is ridiculous. You're exaggerating. It's like, no, this is how I've spent the last 30 years. I know how this comes out. And that is what keeps me up at night.
I wrote a piece along those lines at some point in the past for The Atlantic, which is the fact that you end up feeling kind of like a Cassandra. You know, that's like, well, you know, generally speaking, this is the pattern and we're moving into that pattern. And it's not to say, and I think it's important to say this, it's not to say that you can predict what's going to happen or that history repeats because it doesn't. But you can see patterns in American history over the long haul and they're significant and you can't ignore them. Or if you do ignore them, you're ignoring some pretty tough realities, which in our current moment, lots of people are particularly eager to do. But no, the fact of the matter is anyone who knows American history knows the patterns that the United States and its citizens tend to fall into. And yeah, we're in a moment where those patterns potentially are at play. And to pretend that they don't exist or to declare that you will no longer teach them in schools or to accuse people of being hysterical or of exaggerating or all of the other things that people say when people step forward and say, you know, we have a really long history of abusing voting rights to silence people and shut them out. We also have a long history of people shutting up that message and silencing people who step forward to resist that. And so, yeah, I think that's part of it too, is that as historians, we have a gut understanding of some of these patterns. Not that they're going to repeat, but we sure as recognize them for what they are. And if you have that gut feeling, how can you just watch it without wanting to alert other people to the fact that that's what's in play and get other people to share your sense of something highly significant being at threat and that there must be action. In a way, we just had a long conversation about what pushes people into feeling that they need to take action. And what we're saying here now is you and I, in some way, are trying to help that process by stepping forward in the public and saying to people, hey, I'm a person, and I think this is important, and I think this is dangerous, and I think you folks should know that too.
Well, I do think also that it is not insignificant that there has been such a backlash among women, especially among older women, against what's happening in our government now. And I think it's including a lot of people who were perhaps not in the past comfortable being included in political discussions. And that is, I think, a really important piece that is probably unprecedented in our history, in that our generation, I think, is the first generation of women who get to a certain age, around 60, late 50s, mid 60s, and can still look forward to, you know, 20, 30 productive years. They have education, sometimes they have money, they have connections, and increasingly now they're getting a language for political involvement that they didn't have before. And I think that that matters, that the inclusion of those voices and the recognition that you are not alone matters and is getting people to turn out and to make a stand for this democracy.
A language and a credibility and authority, because I think it mattered enormously to see the number of women who were voted into Congress recently, to see that change in representation in a very literal kind of a way. I think, you know, not that I've heard people step back and say, this changed my thinking, but I think seeing that and hearing, you know, so much of the talk of, you know, women need to run for office, women need to step forward, that kind of credibility and that kind of authority to step forward and assert yourself that way as a woman, and the fact that that's not a shocking thing to do, but it's actually an expected and even necessary thing to do right now. It's not necessarily new in any way, but it's loud right now.
I think what's new is this generational moment when there are scripts written for how to be a young woman, and there's scripts written for how to be, you know, a college student, and there's scripts written for women for each stage of their lives. But I think we're the first generation to have this pretty significant chunk of our lives that doesn't have a script written for it yet. And women are writing that script now and discovering whole new ways of participating in the community and in the world that are really exciting and interesting. And I think we'll write a new kind of history for what it means to be, you know, an older woman in our society. That's not to say other people aren't active. You know, certainly young people are getting out there, and there's, you know, all kinds of new magazines and new discussions, which we didn't even cover, of different political opportunities and all sorts of things like that as well. But I'm interested in that demographic, probably because I'm part of it, but I'm interested in that demographic because it does seem to me so largely unwritten right now.
I think that's a really interesting way to think about it. I just would add to and underline the fact that women of color are a big part of this moment. Their voices are being heard in a way that perhaps other people have not been willing to hear them before, and that deserves a lot of recognition.
Yes, and not only in the present, of course, although I do think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has really changed the way that, maybe not changed it, maybe gone back to an old way of how Congress people interact with their constituents. She did a series of, well, I mean, of course, all of her videos that she does on TikTok and the videos that she did at the end of last year talking about what she had done for her constituents. It was absolutely brilliant. I don't know if you saw it, but it was on Twitter, and everyone's like, why doesn't everybody do this? Because it, you know, it was like, not necessarily something that matters to you if you're living in Montana, but she's literally saying, we got this many coats, winter coats, to this many kids. And I mean, it was just absolutely brilliant. But there's the people who are there in the present, but it has been really interesting to me how many new biographies we have of Fannie Lou Hamer, Ida B. Wells, people looking back and saying, wait a minute, there are already patterns of women's activism that historians have known about. Of course, we know how incredibly important women were in the second civil rights movement, especially, but also in the earlier civil rights movement. But to have people that are not necessarily academics suddenly going, wait a minute, Fannie Lou Hamer's speaking to me.
That's what I think stands out right now, is that there are people who are able and willing to hear things and see things that perhaps they weren't willing to before, and that's part of this moment when, you know, your idea about things being unscripted is interesting. I definitely feel that there's a lot about this historical moment in general that feels unscripted. You know, there are things happening right now that they've happened perhaps individually before, but not necessarily in this combination before. So there are some ways in which some of what we're going through now generally is not necessarily unprecedented, but difficult to predict. We come back to my word contingency, which I say about every nanosecond and have for the last few years. I don't know. It's interesting, but I think I agree with what you're saying. And I guess as my historian brain is alert and interested to see what happens as this population of women, many different kinds of women, move forward and continue to move into their own and to learn the best way to use their voices to make change, because that's where we are.
I actually have a theory about where this is going, but maybe we should save that for another episode.
leave people hanging.
Well, we have been in a hyper-masculinized moment, really, since at least the 1980s. And it is not a traditional American moment at all. It is a specific moment in American history that has given us this idea that somehow being an American is being individualistic man who is dominant and rejects the concept of community organizing and all that. But there is at least one more, but many more different patterns of American history that have emphasized community and family and the family-centered vision of a society. And I wonder if one of the things that the increased emphasis of women and communities on our political activism is going to do is going to bring that back. And, you know, if you look at Stacey Abrams's ads when she ran for governor, were really striking, as were many people in that election. They were all about community. They weren't about nuclear families. They were about communities. So you had her, you had Tammy Duckworth talking about the family, if you will, of those who rescued her in Iraq. You know, there was that changing sense of what it meant to be an American. And I wonder if women's involvement is going to change that central concept of who we've been since really the 1980s.
That's really interesting. I mean, there have been moments in the past where ideas of manhood were bound up with community and family. And right now we're kind of in the opposite of that, as you said. We're in this sort of hyper-masculine, individual, tough guy moment.
Cowboy,
yeah, moment. But given what we've just been saying about women in this moment, and given that one of the major crises among the many that we're experiencing right now has to do with an absence of a sense of community writ large and small, right? The absence, I say this all the time also, I say contingency all the time, and I always talk about the we. We lack a we, that if you're unwilling to put on a mask for some other human being, then you're not thinking about we at all, you're thinking about you. It would make perfect sense that in this moment with women having louder voices that are listened to in a different way, that part of that might also be a movement away from cowboy individualism towards community. That would be a healthy and positive thing. Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.